The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. Prologue. The Storming of Seringapatam, 1799. Extracted from a family paper. I address these lines, written in India, to my relatives in England. My object is to explain the motive which has induced me to refuse the right hand of friendship to my cousin, John Herncastle. The private difference between my cousin and me took its rise in a great public event in which we were both concerned, the storming of Seringapatam under General Baird on the 4th of May, 1799. In order that the circumstances may be clearly understood, I must revert for a moment to the period before the assault, and to the stories current in our camp of the treasure in jewels and gold stored up in the palace of Seringapatam. One of the wildest of these stories related to a yellow diamond, a famous gem in the native annals of India. The earliest known traditions describe the stone as having been set in the forehead of the four-handed Indian god who typifies the moon. Partly from its peculiar colour, partly from a superstition which represented it as feeling the influence of the deity whom it adorned, and growing and lessening in lustre with the waxing and waning of the moon, it first gained the name by which it continues to be known in India to this day, the name of the Moonstone. The adventures of the Yellow Diamond begin with the 11th century of the Christian era in the holy city of Somnath. Here, Vishnu the Preserver appeared to three Brahmins in a dream. The deity commanded that the Moonstone should be watched from that time forth by three priests in turn, night and day, to the end of the generations of men. And the Brahmins heard and bowed before his will. The deity predicted certain disaster to the presumptuous mortal who laid hands on the sacred gem, and to all of his house and name who received it after him. And the Brahmins caused the prophecy to be written over the gates of the shrine in letters of gold. One age followed another, and still, generation after generation, the successors of the three Brahmins watched their priceless moonstone night and day. One age followed another, until the first years of the 18th Christian century saw the reign of Aurangzebe, Emperor of the Mughals. At his command, havoc and rapine were let loose once more among the temples of the worship of Brahma. The shrine of the four-handed god was polluted by the slaughter of sacred animals. The images of the deities were broken in pieces, and the moonstone was seized by an officer of rank in the army of Aurangzebe. Powerless to recover their lost treasure by open force, the three guardian priests followed and watched it in disguise. The generations succeeded each other. The warrior who had committed the sacrilege perished miserably. The moonstone passed, carrying its curse with it, from one lawless Mohammedan hand to another. And still, through all chances and changes, the successors of the three guardian priests kept their watch, waiting the day when the will of Vishnu the Preserver should restore to them their sacred gem. Time rolled on from the first to the last years of the 18th Christian century. The diamond fell into the possession of Tipu, Sultan of Seringapatam, who caused it to be placed as an ornament in the handle of a dagger, and who commanded it to be kept among the choicest treasures of his armory. So, as told in our camp, ran the fanciful story of the Moonstone. Let me now take you on to the day of the assault. The camp followers committed deplorable excesses, and, worse still, the soldiers found their way, by an unguarded door, into the treasury of the palace, and loaded themselves with gold and jewels. While I was vainly trying to establish order, I heard a frightful yelling on the other side of the courtyard, and at once ran towards the cries in dread of finding some new outbreak of the pillage in that direction. I got to an open door and saw the bodies of two Indians, by their dress, as I guessed, officers of the palace, lying across the entrance, dead. A cry inside hurried me into a room which appeared to serve as an armory. A third Indian, mortally wounded, was sinking at the feet of a man whose back was towards me. The man turned at the instant when I came in, and I saw John Herncastle, my cousin, with a torch in one hand and a dagger dripping with blood in the other. A stone, set like a pommel in the end of the dagger's handle, flashed in the torchlight as he turned on me like a gleam of fire. The dying Indian sank to his knees, pointed to the dagger in Herncastle's hand, and said in his native language, "The Moonstone will have its vengeance yet on you and yours." He spoke those words and fell dead on the floor. Before I could stir in the matter, the men who had followed me across the courtyard crowded in. My cousin rushed to meet them like a madman. "Clear the room!" he shouted to me, "and set a guard on the door." The men fell back as he threw himself on them with his torch and his dagger. I put two sentinels of my own company, on whom I could rely, to keep the door. Through the remainder of the night, I saw no more of my cousin, and we have not spoken since. Although I attach no sort of credit to the fantastic Indian legend of the gem, I must acknowledge, before I conclude, that I am influenced by a certain superstition of my own in this matter. It is my conviction, or my delusion, no matter which, that crime brings its own fatality with it. I am not only persuaded of Herncastle's guilt, I am even fanciful enough to believe that he will live to regret it if he keeps the diamond, and that others will live to regret taking it from him if he gives the diamond away. The Story. First Period. The Loss of the Diamond. 1848. The events related by Gabriel Betteridge, House Steward in the service of Julia, Lady Verinder. The question of how I am to start the story properly, I have tried to settle in two ways. First, by scratching my head, which led to nothing. Second, by consulting my daughter, Penelope, which has resulted in an entirely new idea. Penelope's notion is that I should set down what happened regularly, day by day, beginning with the day when we got the news that Mr. Franklin Blake was expected on a visit to the house. When you come to fix your memory with a date in this way, it is wonderful what your memory will pick up for you upon that compulsion. Beginning then on Penelope's plan, I beg to mention that I was specially called one Wednesday morning into my lady's own sitting room, the date being the 24th of May, 1848. "Gabriel," says my lady, "here is news that will surprise you. Franklin Blake has come back from abroad. He has been staying with his father in London, and he is coming to us tomorrow to stop till next month and keep Rachel's birthday." If I had had a hat in my hand, nothing but respect would have prevented me from throwing that hat up to the ceiling. I had not seen Mr. Franklin since he was a boy, living along with us in this house. He was, out of all sight, as I remembered him, the nicest boy that ever spun a top or broke a window. The Thursday was as fine a summer's day as ever you saw, and my lady and Miss Rachel, not expecting Mr. Franklin till dinner time, drove out to lunch with some friends in the neighbourhood. Concluding to set myself in the warm summer air, seeing that what is good for old claret is equally good for old age, I took up my beehive chair to go out into the back court, when I was stopped by hearing a sound like the soft beating of a drum on the terrace of my lady's residence. Going round to the terrace, I found three mahogany-coloured Indians in white linen frocks and trousers looking up at the house. The Indians, as I saw on looking closer, had small hand drums slung in front of them. I judged the fellows to be strolling conjurers, and one of the three, who spoke English, and who exhibited, I must own, the most elegant manners, presently informed me that my judgment was right. He requested permission to show his tricks in the presence of the lady of the house. I informed the Indian that the lady of the house was out, and I warned him and his party off the premises. He made me a beautiful bow in return, and he and his party went off the premises. On my side, I returned to my beehive chair and set myself down on the sunny side of the court and fell, if the truth must be owned, not exactly into a sleep, but into the next best thing to it. I was roused on a sudden by a voice shouting for me by my name. "Betteridge!" cries the voice. "Where are you?" "Here!" I shouted out in return, without a notion in my mind of who it was. Before I could get on my legs, a bright-eyed young gentleman plumped down by the side of me, put his arm round my neck, foreign fashion, and gave me a hug that fairly squeezed the breath out of my body. "Dear old Betteridge," says he, "do you know who I am?" "Lord bless us and save us! Here, 4 good hours before we expected him, was Mr. Franklin Blake." "Welcome back to the old place, Mr. Franklin," I said. "All the more welcome, sir, that you have come some hours before we expected you." "I have a reason for coming before you expected me," answered Mr. Franklin. "I suspect, Betteridge, that I have been followed and watched in London for the last 3 or 4 days, and I have travelled by the morning instead of the afternoon train because I wanted to give a certain dark-looking stranger the slip." Those words did more than surprise me. They brought back to my mind in a flash the 3 jugglers. "Who's watching you, sir, and why?" I inquired. "I suspect," says Mr. Franklin, pulling a little sealed paper parcel out of his pocket, "that it concerns this." "And this, Betteridge, means my Uncle Herncastle's famous diamond." "Good Lord, sir," I broke out. "How do you come to be in charge of the wicked Colonel's diamond?" "The wicked Colonel's will has left his diamond as a birthday present to my cousin Rachel," says Mr. Franklin. "My father, as the wicked Colonel's executor, has given it in charge to me to bring down here." "Question the first. Was the Colonel's diamond the object of a conspiracy in India?" "Question the second. Has the conspiracy followed the Colonel's diamond to England?" "Question the third. Did the Colonel know the conspiracy followed the diamond, and has he purposely left a legacy of trouble and danger to his sister through the innocent medium of his sister's child? That is what I am driving at, Betteridge. Don't let me frighten you." It was all very well to say that, but he had frightened me. "I don't want to alarm my aunt without reason," he said, "and I don't want to leave her without what may be a needful warning. If you were in my place, Betteridge, tell me, in one word, what would you do?" In one word, I told him. "Wait." "With all my heart," says Mr. Franklin. "How long?" I proceeded to explain myself. "As I understand it, sir," I said, "somebody is bound to put this plaguey diamond into Miss Rachel's hands on her birthday, and you may as well do it as another." "Very good. This is the 25th of May, and the birthday is on the 21st of June. We have got close on 4 weeks before us. Let's wait and see what happens in that time, and let's warn my lady or not, as the circumstances direct us." "Perfect, Betteridge, as far as it goes," says Mr. Franklin. "But between this and the birthday, what's to be done with the diamond?" "You put it in the safekeeping of the bank at Frizinghall." Frizinghall was our nearest town, and the Bank of England wasn't safer than the bank there. "And if I were you, sir," I added, "I would ride straight away with it to Frizinghall before the ladies come back." We had the fleetest horse in the stables saddled in a hurry, and Mr. Franklin rattled off in a hurry to lodge the cursed diamond once more in the strong room of a bank.